Welcome to the Athenaeum Review podcast, where we talk about the ideas that shape our world. I'm Ben Lima, and our guest today is Casey Fiesler, who's Assistant Professor of Information Science at the University of Colorado. She's received grants and fellowships from the National Science Foundation, the Berkman Klein Center for Internet and Society at Harvard, the Google Policy Fellowship, the Silicon Flatirons Institute, and along with having a PhD in human-centered computing, she also holds a law degree and has worked in intellectual property and internet law. Thank you for being with us today.
Thank you.
I wanted to start by just how you originally arrived at your area of research, or sort of how you got into this from the beginning.
So I originally studied psychology in college, and I was fascinated by the internet. This was in the early 2000s, and so I took a number of computer science classes and then found out about this thing called human-computer interaction, which was people and computers, right, which was great. And I ended up moving towards technology and the internet and law because of my interest in online communities. And the regulation of the internet was a very interesting thing, right, in the early 2000s.
Right.
And then partway through law school, I decided I was very interested in this area, but didn't want to be a lawyer. So that's how I moved into getting a PhD. And I've always been studying the intersection of technology and law and human behavior, particularly in spaces where rules are unclear, which is actually how I moved on to internet research ethics,
yes,
a space where the rules are very unclear.
Okay. One of the areas that is looking at these terms of service, and so I had this question now, just as sort of a user, as a sort of, let's say, ignorant user. You know, when I encounter terms of service, look at them and I kind of shrug my shoulders and I scroll down and I click and say, you know, it's pointless. I don't have any control. I'm just going to click. I don't even care. I mean, is that a stupid thing to do? Or, I mean, do you have any advice for like the user who's trying to deal with this? Should I somehow try to be more careful? Or,
I mean, that's pretty much the common approach to terms
right.
of service.
Okay.
I actually think that one of the things that's happening with these policies and with privacy in particular is a kind of learned helplessness.
Right.
Like,
right.
why bother?
Yeah.
I mean, the other thing is that even if you read the terms of service or tried to read the terms of service, they're written at such a difficult reading level that most people wouldn't actually understand what they were reading. And they often take these extremely broad rights in your content and your data, for example, that doesn't provide you any information about what they're actually going to do with it.
Yeah.
I don't know that I necessarily have any advice about what you should do instead. The one thing I will say is that for really big platforms like Facebook, it's actually unlikely that there are any insane kind of gotchas because there's so much scrutiny
on
them. And so you're going to hear about something crazy that's happening with like Facebook's privacy policy. I tend to be more concerned about like tiny little apps.
Right.
And so So for really small platforms or tiny apps, I tend to be very cautious if they ask me for a kind of data that seems unusual. But I think that you're not unusual at all in your, you know, not paying attention to terms of service. And the good news is that companies do tend to pay a lot of attention to public relations disasters, and that often changes things, which to me suggests something about the power of collective action and that there actually are things that people can do to make policies better.
Right.
But first they have to notice the bad things that are happening.
I was coming, you know, connecting, I guess, with the kind of legal question, you know, I just said how I feel so fatalistic as a user, like I don't have control. But then I had the impression that maybe in different countries, like is it true that in Europe, for example, are users, would you say that users are better protected through privacy law and things like that? Or is it possible to reform laws to make people more secure? I mean, that's a broad question, but.
Yeah, so actually the EU is a really good example because you might remember back less than a year ago, March, April, May last year, you got approximately 50 emails a
Yes.
day informing you that privacy policies had changed on
Yeah.
literally everything you use.
Yeah.
And that's because of EU data protection.
Right.
So the good thing is that it's really, really hard for a platform to just protect the privacy of EU citizens.
Right.
So thanks to the EU, now everyone has
No, yeah,
better
okay.
privacy protection.
Yeah.
So that's a good thing. And I think that's if this works, which is unclear, it hasn't
Yeah.
even been a year
Yeah.
yet, then it's possible that just the EU having decided to pass better privacy protections has an impact on data practices for companies across the entire world.
Yeah. Well, that's, I guess that's a little bit encouraging. I do remember getting all those notices. A few minutes ago in the meeting we were or you're talking about the concept of or the term vulnerable and how certain users can be vulnerable in certain situations. And I wanted to ask you about the role of anonymity, because thinking about kind of the classic case of like Facebook versus Twitter, where it's, quote unquote, real name on Facebook and then lots of anonymous people on Twitter. But on the one hand, someone might say, well, if I'm anonymous, then maybe I could be a little bit safer from, I don't want my real information to get out and I have some protection. But then on the other hand, that anonymity also seems to enable harassment and things like this. And it seems like a tough problem. And I just kind of wonder what your thoughts are about like real names versus anonymous.
Yeah, this is definitely a, as you say, a tough problem. I actually was talking to my ethics and policy class recently about real name policies.
Yeah.
So, for example, there was a lot of discussion around this with respect to Facebook
Yeah.
and the fact that it requires real names, and at some point they cracked down more on this. I was actually a little surprised that some of the students in my class, their initial attitude was, well, why would you need to be anonymous? You don't have to be anonymous unless you have something to hide. And I think that it's easy to forget that there are lots and lots of reasons why someone might not want to reveal their real identity
Yeah.
online that have nothing to do with being a bad actor.
Yeah.
It's definitely true that anonymity has had a negative influence in some contexts and that people can hide behind that and use harassment, etc.
Right.
But also, one of the great things about the internet is that it provides a way for people to be more themselves when they can't be themselves in real life. So, a really
Right.
good example of this is LGBT people who might not be out in their real lives.
Yeah.
And tying their real identity to their online identity, where they might be getting social support, could put them in real danger.
Yeah.
Even I have had a pseudonym online, not
Yeah.
because I'm doing anything bad or I'm ashamed of anything, but because I'm an academic, and when you Google my name, I want you to find my academic
Right.
credentials and not the Star Trek fan fiction that I wrote when I was 20.
Right. Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. I mean, I feel the same way. Like if, especially I guess, yeah, in different contexts. Well, I also wanted to ask you, I saw that some of your research was involved with I guess the digital improv project or the use of improvisational micro agents.
You went way
Well, look, you've done so
back.
much. This was just it just caught my eye. I was trying to kind of look over things. I wondered if you could just tell us a little bit about what that was.
Oh my gosh. Well, for anyone who's listening who is a graduate student, you might know that sometimes you do research because there's money for it,
Right.
which is what happened to my first year as a PhD student. I had just finished law school and I started my PhD. And the person who eventually became my advisor at that time did not have any funding. And so she said, "Hey, there's someone over here who is really interested in the fact that you used to study cognitive psychology and
Right.
needs some help
Yeah.
with this project." And so that project was actually creating cognitive models of how improv comedians improvise in order
Oh.
to eventually create AI
Wow.
that can improvise. And so I spent a year watching just hours and hours and hours of footage of improv comedians who came into our lab.
Wow.
And we came up with cognitive models for what they did, also asking them, like showing them video and saying, "Hey, what were you thinking when you did this? What were you thinking when you did this?"
Yeah.
And we simplified some of those concepts to very, very simple things and created these little micro agents
Oh, wow.
that would do little improv comedy games.
Wow. That's amazing. I mean, and was it successful with what you expected from it or
I mean, I think that they were really fun little thought experiments.
Yeah.
And the professor who was leading that work subsequently has done some really great work on expressive AI in general. And so one of the projects that he did created this giant dome where you dance inside it and an AI image dances on the screen with you, where their movements improvise in relationship to what you're doing, so that you're dancing with this.
Wow.
It's really neat.
That sounds so cool. Well, I'm glad I found that one because I want to learn more. Well, so some of the really significant work that you've done in this area of fandom, so I think you mentioned that fandom in at least one sense you can trace it back to Star Trek, which of course has been around for a while. But I guess my question is fandom as we know it essentially defined by kind of the online environment? I mean, was there any, going back before people got on the internet, would we rec have recognized what fandom was back then, or is there something fundamentally different about kind of online fandom versus like Star Trek a few decades ago?
I mean, one of the things to me that has always been fascinating about fandom, and by this I mean transformative fandom, so people who write fan fiction and create remix videos and this kind of thing, is that it has existed since long before the internet.
Okay.
You could even go back before Star Trek and think
Yeah.
about like Jane Austen and Sherlock Holmes book clubs where people were basically writing fan fiction. But what
Wow.
we think of as modern media fandom really did kick off with the original Star Trek series.
Yeah.
That is what kicked off conventions and even fan fiction in the form of fanzines.
Okay.
So we're talking writing stories, drawing art, Xeroxing, copying, having
Right.
to hand them in person to people. And even in the 80s, people were creating fan vids, a type of remix video using VCRs. But the internet allowed distribution to just explode.
Yeah.
So it used to be that you had to, hand things by hand to people, these fanzines, etc. And suddenly, fandom became much easier for a lot more people to participate in.
Yeah.
But this is what has been so fascinating for my research and why fandom has been such an interesting place to look at copyright norms in particular, is because they have nothing to do with the internet. I mean, they've obviously been influenced, but a lot of the social norms in fandom have existed since before the internet, and they're not tied to any particular technology,
Oh, okay.
which is really unusual.
Yeah. Oh, wow. I mean, just to follow up, you mentioned Jane Austen and Sherlock Holmes. So people were kind of writing and sharing their stories with these characters, like the 20th century or 19th century, or
Yeah, it was happening back then too. I mean,
okay,
obviously not as common,
right,
and not as easy to distribute. It was a more casual kind of activity, but yeah.
I was also curious, and I know you've discussed this or think touched on it, but about the gendered aspect of, I guess, let's say maybe different fandoms, or if, you know, there's certain dynamics or cultures that take shape in a gendered way, depending on the context. And I wondered if you could talk a little bit about how some of the gender dynamics work.
So traditionally, fandom is predominantly women.
Okay.
Some of the early fan studies scholars, early 90s, wrote about this and had some speculations as to kind of some reasons
right.
this might be. Some of them even relate a bit to intellectual property and sort of the ways that women tend to want to play with worlds sometimes more.
Right.
But there, it certainly can be different in different fan communities.
Yeah.
For example, perhaps counterintuitively, My Little Pony fandom is mostly men.
Why is that?
That is probably a very complicated answer.
Okay. Yeah,
right?
Yeah.
I mean, I would say that sort of transformative fandom online is still, according to surveys that I've done and
right.
Some census that has been taken in fandom, is still mostly women. Interestingly, the last survey that we did, there were more people who identified as trans or genderqueer than there were cis men.
Wow.
In our sample.
Wow. So, but are there, I mean, aside from My Little Pony, which sounds interesting, but are there other cultures or fandoms that are predominantly male or
I mean, there's,
or
so,
not so much?
Well, there's certainly, so I'm talking here about transformative fandom, which
right.
is like centered around fan creation.
Okay.
There's certainly, you know, the other kind of fandom, like people talking about Star Trek on Twitter or whatever.
Yeah, yeah.
And those, that's a, can be a very different demographic.
Okay.
Yeah.
And I think you use the term curative. So there's, correct me if I'm wrong, transformative is where you're like you're writing actors, and the other kind is where you're just sort of discussing and not necessarily creating a
And I think the term curative came from actually thinking about it in terms of like collecting. Collecting, discussing, collecting facts even.
Okay.
As opposed to the creative aspect of it being really central to the community.
Okay. I was also curious, let's say, I don't know what the term is, but the let's say the original publishers, or the, you know, the person who, the people who own the copyrights for Star Trek or whatever, is at this point, is fandom largely embraced, or are there still authors or publishers who try to kind of attack transformative fandom? Or...
So I would say in a broad general sense that it is left alone at
yeah.
the very least, and often embraced.
Yeah.
There are still individual authors in particular who are very vocal about not wanting fan fiction written about their work.
Right.
Anne Rice is one, George R. R. Martin is another. And a lot of fans will respect that in a sort of ethical sense.
Okay.
But from a legal sense, they have no leg to stand on.
Oh, okay. Right. So, yeah.
And there has never been a formal legal challenge to non-commercial fan works.
Yeah.
But I will say, so the non-commerciality aspect is not only a very strong social norm in fandom because of the gift economy
sense of it,
but it also helps protect fandom from legal challenge, because even though something could be fair use if it was commercial,
yeah.
it's much more likely that someone's going to come after you if you try to sell some kind of remix. And there was recently a court case about a Star Trek fan film that did not go in their favor.
Okay. speaking of ethics and so forth, I was curious in your work teaching, or your as a faculty member, and kind of the way that ethics is or is not integrated into kind of what students learn. Do you feel that, or have you found that that students are able to sort of get and grapple with these kind of ethical issues as they're brought in, or do you think there still needs to be more done to kind of ensure that the ethical questions are integrated into the curriculum.
So one of the things that I've been thinking about a lot lately is ethics education in computer science in particular.
Yeah.
And I do think that there's a problem with the way that it is traditionally taught,
yeah.
which is as a standalone class, often towards the end of a degree program.
Right.
I think that this causes problems because it reinforces the idea that ethics is a specialization
yeah.
and not actually integral to technical practice.
Right.
So when you're learning to code or you're learning machine learning or AI or how to scrape data,
yeah.
these ethical questions are not coming up as part of doing that thing.
Yeah.
Instead, it comes up later as kind of an add-on.
Yeah.
And I worry that that reinforces basically the, well, I'm just the problem.
Right. Yeah.
So I think that one solution to that is to integrate ethics into these technical classes. And this is something that a lot of people are starting to push for now, and something that I would like to personally do to the extent that I can have control over this in
right.
classes I'm not teaching.
Yeah, it seems pretty important. Well, I also, I just wanted to ask, can you talk a little bit about your projects and kind of what you're working on next? I know there's a lot.
Yeah, I mean, actually, I'll give you sort of an overview of some of the different areas I have, because I'm working on some things that are quite different.
Okay.
So I have the technology ethics work, which is partly around research ethics, like scraping data and that kind of thing. I also have a PhD student right now who is very interested in how can we create more ethical tech environments in the industry. I have a student who's doing a lot of work on content moderation online,
mm-hmm.
something that I'm very interested in is sort of governance of platforms. And so
yeah.
he's actually been interviewing moderators on Discord to figure out how do we moderate voice?
Yeah. yeah.
Like, it's very interesting because you have to like catch someone in the act of doing something
yeah.
bad in order to ban them. And then I have a student who's doing work on the fandom community stuff.
Yeah.
That is focused in privacy norms in this community and how it can be an LGBT support space and that kind of thing. When I describe all of my research together, which can sometimes be challenging, but I like to think that I'm working on ways to make networked technologies safer and more inclusive and more positive,
yeah.
whether that has to do with the people creating them being more ethical, or it has to do with the communities being able to regulate themselves
yeah.
In more effective ways.
It seems like really important stuff.
Thank you.
Given how powerful these media are and how much time and mental energy we all have, so that's really cool. Well, this is the Athenaeum Review podcast, and our guest today is Casey Fiesler. Thank you for being with us. The Athenaeum Review podcast is produced by Creative Disturbance. Find out more at creativedisturbance.org.